Remember, if you bought a house anywhere but Santa Barbara, you didn't pay enough. Joining me is Jim Burling. He is Pacific Legal Foundation's Director of Litigation and Principal Attorney in the PLF's Property Rights Practice Group. He's been with the PLF since 1983. He must be very old. His cases involve regulatory taking, environmental and land use regulations, eminent domain, Indian law. Wow, wonder if he knows anything about the Chumash, what's going on in San Ynez. In 2001, he successfully argued a leading property rights case, Palazzolo versus Rhode Island, before the United States Supreme Court. He's a frequent lecturer, continuing legal education courses, topics such as wetlands, eminent domain, the taking of private property. Mr. Burling is also the chairman emeritus of the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group and a member of the American College of Real Estate Lawyers. Welcome to Radio Real Estate, Jim Burling. Let's try that again. We didn't have you on. Welcome to Radio Real Estate, Jim Burling.
I'm very glad to be with you today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You're kind of, we got the top dog. We were going to get a hold of John Groen, who's kind of he's the lead attorney on this case called Murr versus State of Wisconsin and St. Croix County. And it's a taking case. And we're very lucky to have Jim here to tell us about the case, who the principals are, and why the PLF decided to take on this case. So you're up.
I'm up. This is a case that we're trying to get the United States Supreme Court to take up, and it's a really interesting fact situation. It started out in 1960 when William Murr, who is a plumber, he owns a small plumbing business back in 1960, bought a lot, about an acre and a half. And he built a 950-square-foot home on the lot, and this is a vacation home for him, his wife, and their six children. And for years and years and years, they went to this vacation home. It was right on the shores of Lake Croix, Lake St. Croix in Wisconsin, which is a very pretty area, a lot of woods around it, just a beautiful area up in Wisconsin. And a few years later, he decided to buy another lot, a next-door lot, and that was in 1963, and he bought this same-size lot, and the idea was it would be set aside for investment purposes, where the first lot was owned by his plumbing company, the second lot they owned separately. And things were going along quite well until 41 years later, in 2004, the Murr children, and the Murr children by this time owned both of the lots in their names. Four of the children ended up with the lots as William Murr and his wife ultimately passed on. And they owned this separate lot, and they decided in 2004 it was really time to fix up the 950-square-foot vacation home. They wanted to raise it up to avoid flooding issues, and they wanted to make obvious improvements. I mean, you think of a house built in 1960, a lot of things can be improved. So they thought what they would do is they would sell the other lot so somebody else could develop it, maybe get a few permits. And then they were told that, these lots are now too small to be developed. You cannot develop a lot that is only an acre and a quarter because if you take care of the wetland buffer, the steep slope buffer, the access buffer, et cetera, you don't have enough land to build on. But they said, well, what if somebody owned this separately? Could they build on it? They said, yeah, they would be grandfathered. If you own this property for the last 20 years, you'd be grandfathered and you can build it. Well, why can't we? Because we consider, because you own two separate lots, there's a forced involuntary merger where both of these lots are considered one lot. Therefore, you can't build a second home, and you can't even sell the second lot to somebody else because it's now considered one lot. Well, they sued. They sued and argued this was a regulatory taking, meaning that the government has denied all use of this one lot. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court ultimately said, no, we are considering you to have one lot. And true, if you owned just a single lot of this size and you couldn't use it, then maybe there is a taking, then maybe government would have to pay you for it or at least allow you to build a home. But because you were smart enough to buy an extra lot back in 1963, you are basically being told today there's no relief. And so this is the doctrine that the Wisconsin Supreme Court and a number of other states have adopted it as well, that the more land you own, the more government can steal. Let me give you another example. Say you're a farmer and you own 100 acres and 10 acres is wetland. You can't use that 10 acres. Well, the government says you have 90% left, no taking. If all you owned was the 10 acres and you couldn't use any of that 10 acres, then there would be a taking and you're entitled to compensation. So people owning more land have less rights.
Then they're penalized. And in this case, we're not talking about some large developer wanting to put up condos on the lakeshore. It's just a like you said, a simple family. So if we can go back, if I understand this correctly, would you think back in 1960, 1963, 1.5 acres allowed you to build whatever it allowed you to build? Do you think zoning has changed and they so now that there's different, more restrictions?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with every year, we know that we get more and more restrictions put on zoning. And yeah, if they owned a 1 1/4 acre flat lot with no wetlands on it, no steep slope, no buffer zones, then they could develop it today. But they can't because of all these other restrictions have left them with less than a half an acre of so-called buildable lot. And that's below the minimum size that is required in this area to build. So every year that you have property and you don't build on it, the odds are increased that there's going to be some sort of restrictive zoning. And, of course, that has the impact of making people think really hard before they buy extra property or, hey, we better develop this today because we might not be able to develop it tomorrow. And that's certainly counterproductive if you're trying to protect the environment.
My guess is Jim Burling is the director of litigation for the Pacific Legal Foundation, talking about a case, Murr versus State of Wisconsin in St. Croix County. So I could, trying to think, well, if they bought, let's say they bought one parcel in 1960 and it was 3 acres and the zoning was 1.5 acres, so they always thought they were going to split the lot to 1.5 acres each. And then years later, instead of 1.5 acre minimum, it changed to 3 acre minimum. I could think, well, you know, you lost out. You own a 3 acre lot and now it's 3 acre minimum. You can't split the lot. But they buy two parcels, two separate parcels, and this forced merger, I just can't understand how someone could have come up with a law like that to, you know, it makes no sense. It almost seems irrational.
Yeah,
it seems irrational.
It doesn't make sense, but you come up with a law like that if your desire and your highest aim is to prevent new development.
Well, okay, but let's say that you're okay, that's fine. So let's say you do that. But they shouldn't be able to say that if it was owned by two different people, they would let each individual develop each individual parcel. So then what they're saying is we're not penalizing you because it's 1.5 acres each. We're penalizing you because it just happens to be one owner. That's the real hypocritical part.
Yeah, that really is because it's simply the MERS are being punished for buying the second lot next to their first lot. And it made all the sense in the world that you'd want to do that. Maybe they would eventually want to build a second home for the grandchildren or great-grandchildren. It's cool to have them right next to each other, right? I mean, that's the sort of thing you want to think about, your children and grandchildren doing that. But if they had bought a lot, you know, two lots away or even one lot away from the original one, then they might not be in the same boat either because there would be an intervening lot. So they were doing everything right. They were planning for the future. And because they were planning for the future, the government is now telling them, sorry, we're basically taking this lot away from you.
Now, this goes back. You said this started. The parcel was purchased, the two parcels, 1960, 1963. Then in 2004, with the children who inherited, and then both parcels were under their name, they started this case. Now we're at 2015. So this goes back to 2004?
This goes back 2004 when they started the process of seeing if they could develop it. The lawsuit was filed a few years after that. They first filed a lawsuit arguing that under Wisconsin law they should be able to develop that lot, and they lost that part of it. And the next part is a takings case that goes on. But your point is that these things take forever to happen. And so we're talking about 11 years since they started this process, and they're no further ahead than they were before. except all the attorneys they were paying before we took this case over, because we don't represent them for money. We do it for free because we're a nonprofit. But this has been a long struggle for the MERS. And in fact, anybody trying to sue government for this kind of regulatory taking, the argument that government is taking away the value of the property, these cases generally drag on for years and years and years. We had a case that we won at the Supreme Court a couple years ago. It's been 20 years since that case started, and it's still going on. So the 11 years here is outrageous, but I've seen worse.
It's talking with Jim Burling, Director of Litigation with the Pacific Legal Foundation. We've had a variety of attorneys on from the Pacific Legal Foundation over the years. Unfortunately, the name MER versus State of Wisconsin, MER, that's the start of merger. So maybe that was their problem. It's just kind of like they're merging this lot. It was just,
I hadn't thought of that before, but maybe that was their problem, having the wrong name.
Put that in your closing arguments. So you're now, the Pacific Legal Foundation is now taking this case, and you're looking to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. So where are we at right now, today?
We have filed our petition for cert with the Supreme Court, and that essentially is a request that the court take this case up. We have explained to the court the facts that have gone on here, how wrong it is, and how there are decisions across the country that have gone different ways on this issue. So the doctrine is a real mess across the country. There's no uniformity. And that's one of the things that we're trying to get the court to look at and take this case, just to resolve this issue once and for all. I mean, they've touched on it a few cases. They touched on it in the case that I argued to them in 2001. But the court has actually never taken this question up of forced merger or the parcel as a whole, what's also known as a relevant parcel, trying to figure out how much you own for purposes of determining whether there's been a taking.
And is this kind of case, they've never heard a case like this. I'm wondering, it seems like it would be unusual or rare. I mean, how many people actually own two adjacent contiguous parcels, and then they get caught in the crosshairs here? I mean, how often can that happen?
You know, it happens more often than you think, because we get calls from time to time, you know, a few a year, and just we're one law firm in California, so I'm sure this happens across the country. But the other key aspect of this is the one that I mentioned earlier, is that say you do own, you know, 100 acres and you're a farmer, and 10 acres of that is declared wetland and you cannot use it for any purpose. If that was a developable parcel in and of itself, if you could, you know, normally through the subdivision process develop that parcel, has that been taken? And that issue is going to be affected by what goes on here. So there might not be a lot of people owning two contiguous parcels, although you'll find that a lot in vacation areas. That does happen quite a bit. But what could be even more important for this case is how it affects people who own several acres or more acres of land, such as farmers or ranchers, and its zoning changes dramatically over the years, or environmental restrictions increase more and more. They might get some relief from this case as well.
I was talking to a California Association of Realtors attorney, and we were talking about the arbitration clause in the purchase agreement contract and how you give up your right to an appeal. Can't go to the appellate court if you agree to arbitration. Agree to binding arbitration. You start with mediation. Hopefully that'll resolve it. And he had these incredible stats about California and how many people really ever go to court in the first place. Usually it's resolved through a mediation process. If someone files a lawsuit, it really rarely even gets to court. And the percentage was very low. And then when it gets to court, hardly anyone files an appeal. And then if they do, the appeal it's rarely overturned. So, you know, he was arguing that if you sign arbitration, you give up your right to appeal, it's unlikely that you're giving up much. Now, of course, if you end up in that situation and you want to appeal, you're stuck. So when I'm bringing up that is to ask you, and I don't know if you know, how many cases, like you filed this case to the Supreme Court, you had a cool name for it. What was the name of that?
I call it the more land you own, the more you can steal case.
Oh, no. But the when you file a request to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, it's a petition for writ of certiorari.
Oh, that's why I didn't remember it.
Yeah, that's a mouthful.
Petition for search? for
a
writ?
Petition for cert is a shorthand, right.
Petition for cert. So how many people, law firms, individuals, file this petition for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court every year, and then how many get heard?
There are quite a few that are filed every year, and it's probably on the order of, say, 6 to 10,000 a year, somewhere in there. I have
wow.
the latest statistics. And they grant about 1%. Now, those odds are a little misleading because a lot of those are written by prisoners with more time on their hands than anything to do. So they tend to send in a lot of petitions or cert. Those that are filed by real attorneys with experience in the Supreme Court, there are probably only less than 1,000, somewhere between a few hundred and 1,000 of those. So your odds are better than 1%, but there are an awful lot that go to the court. But quite frankly, the court doesn't spend a lot of time on them because when you have a prisoner sitting in jail somewhere writing a petition for cert on the back of an envelope, they'll look at it, but they're not. It's highly unlikely they're going to pay a whole lot of attention.
And usually they want to see something that's gone to a state Supreme Court first and gone through the channels.
Right, a state Supreme Court or federal courts of appeals. They're rarely going to take a case that comes directly out of trial court. The court isn't going to care if you just have factual errors that have been made. You think the light was green and the judge said it was red, they're not going to hear that kind of appeal.
And is
but
it,
they want to hear cases that are going to have broad nationwide impact when you have conflicting doctrines or interpretation of federal law or the federal constitution that are different in different states, or if it's a really, really important case that the country needs to be resolved. Those are the sort of cases they're going to take on.
And the Pacific Legal Foundation, I don't know if you want to share what, in order for you to go to the Supreme Court, you have to feel that it's a case that they'll take, that I'm sure you guys aren't throwing things out up against the wall, just see what sticks.
Oh, absolutely. We turn down many, many requests for assistance every year because we only want to try to go to the Supreme Court with those cases that we think there's a real likelihood that they're going to take. A case with a real conflict and an issue that we've been following for a while. Because we don't charge for our legal services, and so we don't want to waste our time taking on cases that don't have any chance of getting up there. We have the goal of establishing precedent favorable to property rights, precedent that's going to affect the nation as a whole. And so that's why we try to go through many, many dozens of cases before we'll find one that we think is worthy to go to the Supreme Court ourselves. Then we ask the Supreme Court to take it, and if we're lucky, they will.
And what's your batting average? What is the batting average of the PLF?
Our batting average is pretty good, actually. For a firm of our size, we've had 7 Supreme Court victories over the years, and we'll probably get, I'm trying to think of the exact percentage. Maybe 20% or so. It's somewhere in there, 10, 20%. It's certainly more than the random odds because we do file petitions that aren't granted, but, we had one a couple years ago and one just a year before that.
But you don't only take cases that go to the U.S. Supreme Court, do you? Do you go to state Supreme Courts?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We are in courts in more than half the states of the country. We're in state Supreme Courts across the country, often as amicus curiae or friend of the court briefs. We have cases that we started at the trial court level, and we have about half our cases are at the trial court or court of appeal level, where we file directly starting in the trial court. So, yeah, we take all kinds of cases all across the country.
So, and you take donations. So you look for people to contact the Pacific Legal Foundation. And one of my earliest, I started this radio program in 1998. I've been selling real estate since 88 in Santa Barbara. And one of my earliest listeners contacted me. We became friends. And she died and left a significant amount of money to the Pacific Legal Foundation. Her estate was worth about $5 million, and she didn't have a ton of beneficiaries, and you were one of them.
Well, that makes me feel good to know that people out there understand the value of what we do. You know, we are a nonprofit public interest law firm. Contributions to us are tax deductible. And a lot of people believe thoroughly in the cause of protecting property rights. We have a website, pacificlegal.org or .org, that explains a lot of our cases that we have dealing with environmental regulations, property rights, and the variety of economic issues that we take on. And we are in the business of trying to establish precedents that, you know, make it safe for landowners to own land, make it safe for farmers to farm property, and to just try to achieve protection of property rights as envisioned by our Constitution.
My guest has been Jim Burling, Director of Litigation for the Pacific Legal Foundation. We discussed the case Murr, M-U-R-R, versus State of Wisconsin and St. Croix County, the merger case by the Murrs. Please keep us posted. Hope to have you on again, Jim.
It's been a pleasure talking to
you. All right, thanks.
All right,
thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Mark Schneidman's Radio Real Estate, RadioRealEstate.com. You know, it's good when you take on cases, just some little small family. If we had time, I would have asked them, more questions about developers and big-time stuff. But a lot of the cases that we've discussed over the years, really just small-town items. So we're going to take a break, come back. Maybe we can have time to get to the cost to maintain an estate. What does it cost to maintain a $20 million estate? And maybe I'll tell you about my mom's luggage, which has still not arrived, and it's been going on 72 hours.